Attention to orders!
Major General Marion Diggs wondered what his new command would bring him. The second star on his shoulder, well, he told himself that he could feel the additional weight, but the truth was that he couldn't, not really. His last 5 years in the uniform of his country had been interesting. The first commander of the reconstituted 10th Armored Cavalry Regiment, the Buffalo Soldiers, he'd made that ancient and honored regiment into the drill masters of the Israeli Army, turning the Negev Desert into another national training center. And in 2 years he'd hammered every Israeli brigade commander into the ground, then built them up again, tripling their combat effectiveness by every quantifiable measure. So that now the Israeli troopers' swagger was actually justified by their skills. Then he'd gone off to the real NTC in the high California desert, where he'd done the same thing for his own United States Army. He'd been there when the bio war had begun, with his own 11th ACR, the famous Black Horse Cavalry, and a brigade of National Guardsmen, whose unexpected use of advanced battlefield control equipment had surprised the hell out of the Black Horse and their proud commander, Colonel Al Ham. The whole bunch had deployed to Saudi, along with the 10th from Israel, and together they'd given a world-class bloody nose to the army of the short-lived United Islamic Republic. After acing his colonel command, he'd really distinguished himself as a one-star, and that was the gateway to the second sparkling silver device on his shoulder, and also the gateway to his new command, known variously as First Tanks, Old Ironsides, or America's Armored Division. It was the first armored division, based in Bad Kreuznach, Germany, one of the few remaining heavy divisions under the American flag. Once there had been a lot of them. 2 full corps of them, right here in Germany, 1st and 3rd Armored, 3rd and 8th Infantry, plus a pair of armored cavalry regiments, 2nd and 11th, and the POMCAS sites, monster equipment warehouses, for stateside units like the 2nd Armored and the 1st Infantry, the Big Red One out of Fort Riley, Kansas, which could redeploy to Europe just as fast as the airlines could deliver them, there to load up their equipment and move out. All that force, and it was a whole shitload of force, Diggs reflected, had been part of NATO's commitment to defend Western Europe from a country called the Soviet Union and its mirror image, Warsaw Pact, huge formations whose objective was the Bay of Biscay, or so the operations and intelligence officers in Mons, Belgium, had always thought. And quite a clash it would have been. Who would have won? Probably NATO, Diggs thought, depending on political interference and command skills on both sides of the equation. But now the Soviet Union was no more. And with it was also gone the need for the presence of 5th and 7th Corps in West Germany. And so 1st Armored was about the only vestige left of what had once been a vast and powerful force. Even the cavalry regiments were gone, the 11th to be the OPFOR, opposing force, or bad guys, at the National Training Center, and the 2nd Dragoon Regiment essentially disarmed at Fort Polk, Louisiana, trying to make up new doctrine for weaponless troopers. That left Old Ironsides, somewhat reduced in size from its halcyon days, but still a formidable force. Exactly whom Diggs might fight in the event hostilities sprang unexpectedly from the ground, he had no idea at the moment. That, of course, was the job of his G2 intelligence officer, Lieutenant Colonel Tom Richmond. And training for it was the problem assigned to his G3 operations officer, Colonel Duke Masterman, whom Diggs had dragged kicking and screaming from the Pentagon. It was not exactly unknown in the United States Army for a senior officer to collect about him younger men whom he'd gotten to know on the way up. It was his job to look after their careers, and their jobs to take care of their mentor, called a rabbi in the NYPD or a sea daddy in the United States Navy. In a relationship that was more father-son than anything else. Neither Diggs nor Richmond nor Masterman expected much more than interesting professional time in the 1st Armored Division, and that was more than enough. They'd seen the elephant, a phrase that went back in the United States Army to the Civil War to denote active participation in combat operations, and killing people with modern weapons wasn't exactly a trip to Disney World. A quiet term of training and sans table exercises would be plenty, they all thought. Besides, the beer was pretty good in Germany. "Well, Mary, it's all yours," outgoing Major General, promotable, Sam Goodnight, said after his formal salute. Mary was a nickname for Diggs that went back to West Point, and he was long since past getting mad about it. But only officers senior to him could use that moniker, and there weren't all that many of them anymore, were there? "Sam, looks like you have the kids trained up pretty well," Diggs told the man he'd just relieved. "I'm especially pleased with my helicopter troops. After the hoorah with the Apaches down in Yugoslavia, we decided to get those people up to speed. It took 3 months, but they're ready to eat raw lion now, after they kill the fuckers with their pocket knives." "Who's the boss, Rotorhead?" "Colonel Dick Boyle. You'll meet him in a few minutes. He's been there and done that, and he knows how to run his command." "Nice to know," Diggs allowed, as they boarded the World War II command car to troop the line. A goodbye ride for Sam Goodnight, and welcome for Mary Diggs, whose service reputation was as one tough little black son of a bitch. His doctorate in management from the University of Minnesota didn't seem to count, except to promotion boards, and whatever private company might want to hire him after retirement. A possibility he had to consider from time to time now, though he figured 2 stars were only about half of what he had coming. Diggs had fought in 2 wars and comported himself well in both cases. There were many ways to make a career in the armed services, but none so effective as successful command on the field of battle, because when you got down to it, the Army was about killing people and breaking things as efficiently as possible. It wasn't fun, but it was occasionally necessary. You couldn't allow yourself to lose sight of that. You trained your soldiers so that if they woke up the next morning in a war, they'd know what to do and how to go about it, whether their officers were around to tell them or not. "How about artillery?" Diggs asked, as they drove past the assembled, self-propelled 155mm howitzers. "Not a problem there, Mary. In fact, no problems anywhere. Your brigade commanders all were there in 1991, mainly as company commanders or battalion S3s. Your battalion commanders were almost all platoon leaders or company XOs. They're pretty well trained up. You'll see," Goodnight promised. Diggs knew it would all be true. Sam Goodnight was a major general, promotable, which meant he was going to get star number 3 as soon as the United States Senate got around to approving the next bill with all the flag officers on it. And that couldn't be rushed. Even the president couldn't do that. Diggs had screened for his 2nd star 6 months earlier, just before leaving Fort Irwin, to spend a few months parked in the Pentagon. An abbreviated jointness tour, as it was called, before moving back to Germany. The division was slated to run a major exercise against the Bundeswehr in 3 weeks. 1st AD versus 4 German brigades, 2 tanks, 2 mechanized infantry, and that promised to be a major test of the division. Well, that was something for Colonel Masterman to worry about. It was his neck on the line. Duke had come to Germany a week early to meet with his also-outgoing predecessor as divisional operations officer and go over the exercise's rules and assumptions. The German commander in the exercise was General Major Siegfried Model. Siggy, as he was known to his colleagues, was descended from a pretty good Wehrmacht commander from the old, old days. And it was also said of him that he regretted the fall of the USSR, because part of him wanted to take the Russian army on and rape it. Well, such things had been said about a lot of German and a few American senior officers as well. And in nearly every case, it was just that. Talk. Because nobody who'd seen one battlefield ever yearned to see another. Of course, Diggs thought, there weren't many Germans left who had ever seen a battlefield. "They look good, Sam," Diggs said, as they passed the last static display. "It's a hell of a tough job to leave, Marion. Damn." The man was starting to fight back tears, which was one way of telling who the really tough ones were in this line of work, Diggs knew. Walking away from the command of soldiers was like leaving your kid in the hospital, or maybe even harder. They'd all been Sam's kids, and now they would be his kids, Diggs thought. On first inspection, they looked healthy and smart enough. "Yeah, Arnie," President Ryan said. His voice betrayed his emotions more than a growl or a shout could have. "Nobody ever said the job was fun, Jack. Hell, I don't know why you're complaining. You don't have to schmooze people to raise money for your re-election campaign, do you? You don't have to kiss ass. All you have to do is your work, and that saves you a good hour, maybe an hour and a half, per day to watch TV and play with your kids." If there was anything Arnie loved, Ryan thought, it was telling him, Ryan, how easy he had it in this fucking job. "But I still spend half my day doing unproductive shit instead of doing what I'm paid to do." "Only half, and still he complains," Arnie told the ceiling. "Jack, you'd better start liking this stuff or it'll eat you up. This is the fun part of being president. And hell, man, you were a government employee for 15 years before you came here. You should love being unproductive." Ryan nearly laughed, but managed to contain himself. If there was anything Arnie knew how to do, it was to soften his lessons with humor. That could be annoying as hell. "Fine, but exactly what do I promise them?" "You promise that you'll support this dam and barge canal scheme." "But it's probably a waste of money." "No, it is not a waste of money. It provides employment in this two-state area, which is of interest to not one, not two, but three United States senators, all of whom support you steadfastly on the Hill, and whom you, therefore, must support in turn. You reward them for helping you by helping them get reelected. And you help them get reelected by allowing them to generate about 15,000 construction jobs in the two states. And screw with a perfectly good river for..." Ryan checked the briefing folder on his desk. $3.25 billion. Jesus H. Christ. He finished with a long breath. "Since when have you been a tree hugger? Cutthroat trout don't vote, Jack. And even if the barge traffic up the river doesn't develop, you'll still have one hell of a recreation area for people to water ski and fish, toss in a few new motels, maybe a golf course or two, fast food places." "I don't like saying things and doing things I don't believe in," the president tried next. "For a politician, that is like color blindness or a broken leg. A serious handicap," Van Damme noted. "That's part of the job, too. Nikita Khrushchev said it. Politicians are the same all over the world. We build bridges where there aren't any rivers." "So wasting money is something we're supposed to do?" "Arnie, it isn't our money. It's the people's money. It belongs to them, and we don't have the right to piss it away." "Right. Whoever said this is about what's right?" Arnie asked patiently. "Those three senators who were..." He checked his watch. "On their way down here right now, got you your defense appropriations bill a month ago, in case you didn't remember. And you may need their votes again. Now, that appropriations bill was important, wasn't it?" Yes, of course it was, President Ryan responded with guarded eyes. And getting that bill through was the right thing for the country, wasn't it? Van Damme asked next. A long sigh. He could see where this was going. Yes, Arnie, it was. And so, doing this little thing does help you to do the right thing for the country, doesn't it? I suppose. Ryan hated conceding such things, but arguing with Arnie was like arguing with a Jesuit. You were almost always outgunned. Jack, we live in an imperfect world. You can't expect to be doing the right thing all the time. The best you can expect to do is to make the right thing happen most of the time. Actually, you will do well to have the right things outbalance the not-so-right things over the long term. Politics is the art of compromise, the art of getting the important things you want, while giving to others the less important things they want, and doing so in such a way that you're the one doing the giving, not them doing the taking. Because that's what makes you the boss. You must understand that. Arnie paused and took a sip of coffee. Jack, you try hard and you're learning pretty well, for a fourth grader in graduate school. But you have to learn this stuff to the point that you don't even think about it. It has to become as natural as zipping your pants after you take a piss. You still have no idea how well you're doing. And maybe that's a good thing, Arnie added to himself alone. 40% of the people don't think I'm doing a good job. 59% do, and some of those 40% voted for you anyway. The election had been a remarkable session for write-in candidates, and Mickey Mouse had done especially well, Ryan reminded himself. What am I doing to offend those others? Ryan demanded. Jack, if the Gallup poll had been around in ancient Israel, Jesus would probably have gotten discouraged and gone back to carpentry. Ryan punched a button on his desk phone. Ellen, I need you. Yes, Mr. President, Mrs. Sumter replied to their not-so-secret code. 30 seconds later, she appeared through the door with her hand at her side. Approaching the president's desk, she extended her hand with a cigarette in it. Jack took it and lit it with a butane lighter, removing a glass ashtray from a desk drawer. Thanks, Ellen.
Surely.
She withdrew. Every other day, Ryan would slip her a dollar bill to pay off his cigarette debt. He was getting better at this, mooching usually no more than 3 smokes on a stressful day. Just don't let the media catch you doing that, Arnie advised. Yeah, I know. I can get it on with the secretary right here in the Oval Office, but if I get caught smoking, that's like goddamn child abuse. Ryan took a long hit on the Virginia Slim, also knowing what his wife would say if she caught him doing this. If I were king, then I'd make the goddamn rules. But you're not, and you don't, Arnie pointed out. My job is to preserve, protect, and defend the country. No, your job is to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution, which is a whole lot more complicated. Remember, to the average citizen, preserve, protect, and defend means that they get paid every week, and they feed their families, get a week at the beach every year, or maybe Disney World, and football every Sunday afternoon in the fall. Your job is to keep them content and secure, not just from foreign armies, but from the general vicissitudes of life. The good news is that if you do that, you can be in this job another 7+ years and retire with their love. You left out the legacy part. That made Arnie's eyes flare a bit. Legacy? Any president who worries too much about that is offending God, and that's almost as dumb as offending the Supreme Court. Yeah, and when the Pennsylvania case gets there... Arnie held up his hands as though protecting against a punch. Jack, I'll worry about that when the time comes. You didn't take my advice on the Supreme Court, and so far you've been lucky. But if... No, when that blows up in your face, it won't be pretty. Van Damme was already planning the defense strategy for that. Maybe, but I won't worry about it. Sometimes you just let the chips fall where they may. And sometimes you look out to make sure the goddamn tree doesn't land on you. Jack's intercom buzzed just as he put out the cigarette. It was Mrs. Sumter's voice. The senators just came through the west entrance. I'm out of here, Arnie said. Just remember, you will support the dam and canal on that damned river, and you value their support. They'll be there when you need them, Jack. Remember that. And you do need them. Remember that, too. Yes, Dad, Ryan said. You walked here? Nomura asked, with some surprise.
It is only 2 kilometers, Ming replied airily.
Then she giggled.
It was good for my appetite.
Well, you went through that fettuccine like a shark through a surfer, Nomura thought. I suppose your appetite wasn't hurt very much. But that was unfair. He'd thought this evening through very carefully. And if she'd fallen into his trap, it was his fault more than hers, wasn't it? And she did have a certain charm, he decided, as she got into his company car. They'd already agreed that they'd come to his apartment so that he could give her the present he'd already advertised. Now Nomura was getting a little excited. He'd planned this for more than a week. And the thrill of the chase was the thrill of the chase. And that hadn't changed in tens of thousands of years of male humanity. And now he wondered what was going on in her head. She'd had 2 stiff glasses of wine with the meal, and she'd passed on dessert. She'd jumped right to her feet when he'd suggested going to his place. Either his trap had been superbly laid, or she was more than ready herself. The drive was short, and it passed without words. He pulled into his numbered parking place, wondering if anyone would take note of the fact that he had company today. He had to assume that he was watched here. The Chinese Ministry of State Security probably had an interest in all foreigners who lived in Beijing, since all were potential spies. Strangely, his apartment was not in the same part of the building as the Americans and other Westerners. It wasn't overt segregation or categorization, but it had worked out that way, the Americans largely in one section, along with most of the Europeans. And the Taiwanese, too, Nomura realized. And so whatever surveillance existed was probably over on that end of the complex. A good thing now for Ming, and later perhaps a good thing for himself. His place was a corner second-story walk-up in a Chinese interpretation of an American garden apartment complex. The apartment was spacious enough, about 100 square meters, and was probably not bugged. At least he'd found no microphones when he'd moved in and hung his pictures, and his sweep gear had discovered no anomalous signals. His phone had to be bugged, of course, but just because it was bugged didn't mean that there was somebody going over the tapes every day or even every week. MSS was just one more government agency. And in China, they were probably little different from those in America, or France for that matter. Lazy, underpaid people who worked as little as possible and served a bureaucracy that didn't encourage singular effort. They probably spent most of their time smoking the wretched local cigarettes and jerking off. He had an American Yale lock on the door, with a pick-resistant tumbler, and a sturdy locking mechanism. If asked about this, he'd explain that when living in California for NEC, he'd been burglarized. The Americans were such lawless and uncivilized people. And he didn't want that to happen again.
So, this is the home of a capitalist, Ming observed, looking around.
The walls were covered with prints. Mainly movie posters. Yes, well, it's the home of a salaryman. I don't really know if I'm a capitalist or not, Comrade Ming, he added, with a smile and arched eyebrow. He pointed to his couch. Please have a seat. Can I get you anything?
Another glass of wine, perhaps, she suggested,
spotting and then looking at the wrapped box on the chair opposite the couch.
Nomori smiled.
That I can do. He headed off into the kitchen, where he had a bottle of California Chardonnay chilling in the fridge. Popping the cork was easy enough, and he headed back to the living room with two glasses, one of which he handed to his guest.
Oh, he said, yes, this is for you, Ming.
With that he handed over the box, wrapped fairly neatly in red, of course, gift paper.
May I open it now?
Certainly. Nomori smiled in as gentlemanly a lustful way as he could manage.
Perhaps you would want to unwrap it, well, are you saying in your bedroom?
Excuse me. Just that you might wish some privacy when you open it. Please, pardon me if I am too forward. The mirth in her eyes said it all. Ming took a deep sip of her white wine and walked off into that room and closed the door. Nomori took a small sip of his own and sat down on the couch to await developments. If he'd chosen unwisely, she might throw the box at him and storm out. Not much chance of that, he thought. More likely, even if she found him too forward, she'd keep the present and the box, finish her wine, make small talk, and then take her leave in 30 minutes or so, just to show good manners. Effectively the same result without the overt insult. And Nomori would have to search for another recruitment prospect. No, the best outcome would be... The door opened, and there she stood with a small, impish smile. The boiler suit was gone. Instead, she wore the red-orange bra and panties set, the one with the front closure. She stood there holding her wine glass in salute, and it looked as if she'd taken another sip of her drink, maybe to work up her courage, or to loosen her inhibitions. Nomori found himself suddenly apprehensive. He took another drink himself before standing, and he walked slowly and a little uneasily to the bedroom doorway. Her eyes, he saw, were a little uneasy themselves, a little frightened. And with luck, maybe his were, too, because women everywhere liked their men to be just a little vulnerable. Maybe John Wayne hadn't gotten all the action he wanted, Nomori thought quickly. Then he smiled. I guessed right on the size.
Yes, and it feels wonderful. Like a second skin, smooth and silky.
Every woman has it, Nomori realized. The ability to smile and, regardless of the exterior, show the woman within. Often a perfect woman, full of tenderness and desire, demureness and coquetry. And all you had to do... His hand came out and touched her face as gently as his slight shaking allowed. What the hell was this, he demanded of himself. Shaking? James Bond's hands never shook. This was the time when he was supposed to scoop her up in his arms and stride in a masterful way off to the bed, there to possess her like Vince Lombardi taking over a football team, like George Patton leading an attack. But for all his triumphal anticipation of this moment, things were different from what he'd expected. Whoever or whatever Ming was, she was giving herself to him. There was no more in her than that. That was all she had. And she was giving it to him. He bent his head down to kiss her. And there he caught the scent of the Dream Angel perfume. And somehow it suited the moment perfectly. Her arms came around him sooner than he'd expected. His hands replicated her gesture, and he found that her skin was smooth like oiled silk, and his hands rubbed up and down of their own accord. He felt something strange on his chest, and looked down to see her small hands undoing his buttons. And then her eyes looked into his,
and her face was no longer plain. He unbuttoned his own cuffs, and she forced his shirt off, down his back, then lifted his T-shirt over his head. Or tried to, for her arms were too short to make it quite all the way. And then he hugged her tighter, feeling the silk-like artificial fibers of her new bra rub on his hairless chest. It was then that his hug became harder, more insistent, and his kiss harder on her mouth. And he took her face in his hands and looked hard into her dark, suddenly deep eyes. And what he saw was woman. Her hands moved and unfastened his belt and slacks, which fell to his ankles. He nearly fell himself when he moved one leg, but Ming caught him and both laughed a little as he lifted his feet clear of his loafers and the slacks. And with that they both took a step toward the bed. Ming took another and turned, displaying herself for him. He'd underestimated the girl. Her waist was a full 4 inches slimmer than he'd thought. Must be the damned boiler suit she wore to work, Nomori thought at once. And her breasts filled the bra to perfection. Even the awful haircut seemed right just now, somehow fitting the amber skin and slanted eyes. What came next was both easy and very, very hard. Nomori reached out to her side, pulling her close, but not too close. Then he let his hand wander across her chest, for the first time feeling her breast through the gossamer fabric of the bra, at the same time watching her eyes closely for a reaction. There was little of that, though her eyes did seem to relax, perhaps even smile just a little at his touch. And then came the obligatory next step. With both hands, he unfastened the front closure of the bra. Instantly, Ming's hands dropped to cover herself. What did that mean, the CIA officer wondered. But then her hands dropped, and she pulled him to her. And their bodies met, and his head came down to kiss her again. And his hands slid the bra straps off her arms and onto the floor. There was little left to be done, and both, so it seemed, advanced with a combination of lust and fear. Her hands went down and loosened the elastic band of his briefs, with her eyes now locked on his. And this time she smiled, a for-real smile that made him blush, because he was as ready as he needed to be. And then her hands pushed down on the briefs, and all that left was his socks, and then it was his turn to kneel and pull down on the red silk-like panties. She kicked them loose, and each stood apart to inspect the other. Her breasts were about a large B, Nomori thought, the nipples brown as potting soil. Her waist was not nearly model thin, but a womanly contrast with both the hips and upper body. Nomori took a step and then took her hand and walked her to the bed, laying her down with a gentle kiss. And, for this moment, he was not an intelligence officer for his country. Chapter 10 Lessons of the Trade. The pathway started in Nomori's apartment, and from there went to a website established in Beijing, notionally for Nippon Electric Company. But the site had been designed for NEC by an American citizen who worked for more than one boss, one of whom was a front operated by and for the Central Intelligence Agency. The precise address point for Nomori's email was then accessible to the CIA's Beijing station chief, who, as a matter of fact, didn't know anything about Nomori. That was a security measure to which he would probably have objected, but which he would have understood as a characteristic of Mary Patricia Foley's way of running the Directorate of Operations. And besides which, Station Beijing hadn't exactly covered itself with glory in recruiting senior PRC officials to be American agents in place. The message the station chief downloaded was just gibberish to him, scrambled letters that might as easily have been typed by a chimpanzee in return for a bunch of bananas at some research university, and he took no note of it. Just super-encrypting on his own in-house system called Tapdance, and cross-loading it to an official government communications network that went to a communications satellite, to be downloaded at Sunnyvale, California, then uploaded yet again, and downloaded at Fort Belvoir, Virginia, across the Potomac River from Washington, D.C. From there, the message went by secure fiber-optic landline to CIA headquarters at Langley, and then, first of all, into Mercury, the agency's communications center, where the station Beijing super-encryption was stripped away, revealing the original gibberish, and then cross-loaded one last time to Mrs. Foley's personal computer terminal, which was the only one with the encryption system and daily key selection algorithm for the counterpart system on Chet Nomori's laptop, which was called Intercrypt. MP was doing other things at the time, and took 20 minutes to log into her own system and note the arrival of a Zorga message. That piqued her interest at once. She executed the command to decrypt the message, and got gibberish, then realized, not for the first time, that Nomori was on the other side of the dateline, and had therefore used a different key sequence. So, adjust the date for tomorrow. And yes. She printed a hard copy of the message for her husband, and then saved the message to her personal hard drive, automatically encrypting it along the way. From there it was a short walk to Ed's office. "Hey, baby," the DCI said without looking up. Not too many people walked into his office without announcement. The news had to be good. MP had a beaming smile as she handed the paper over. "Chet got laid last night," the DDO told the DCI. "Am I supposed to break out a cigar?" the director of Central Intelligence asked. His eyes scanned the message. "Well, it's a step forward." "For him, maybe," Ed Foley responded with a twinkling eye. "I suppose you can get pretty horny on that sort of assignment, though I never had that problem myself." The Foleys had always worked the field as a married couple, and had gone through the farm together. It had saved the senior Foley from all the complications that James Bond must have encountered. "Eddie, you can be such a mudge." That made the DCI look up. "Such a what?" "Curmudgeon," she growled. "This could be a real breakthrough. This little chippy is personal secretary to Feng Gan. She knows all sorts of stuff we want to know." "And Chet got to try her out last night. Honey, that's not the same thing as recruitment. We don't have an agent in place quite yet," he reminded his wife.
I know, but I have a feeling about this."
"Woman's intuition?" Ed asked, scanning the message again for any sordid details, but finding only cold facts, as though the Wall Street Journal had covered the seduction. Well, at least Nomori had a little discretion. No rigid, quivering rod plunging into her warm, moist sheath. Though Nomori was 29, and at that age the rod tended to be pretty rigid. "Chet was from California, wasn't he?" the DCI wondered. "So probably not a virgin. Maybe even a competent lover. Though on the first time with anybody you mainly wanted to see if the pieces fit together properly." They always did, at least in Ed Foley's experience. But you still wanted to check and see. He remembered Robin Williams's takeoff on Adam and Eve. "Better stand back, honey. I don't know how big this thing gets." The combination of careful conservatism and out-of-control wishful thinking common to the male of the species. "Okay, so what are you going to reply? How many orgasms did the two of you have?" "God damn it, Ed!" The pin in the balloon worked, the DCI saw. He could almost see steam coming out of his wife's pretty ears. "You know damned well what I'm going to suggest. Let the relationship blossom and ease her into talking about her job. It'll take a while, but if it works, it'll be worth the wait."
And if it doesn't work, it's not a bad deal for Chester, Ed Foley thought. There weren't many professions in the world in which getting sex was part of the job that earned you promotions, were there? Mary?
Yes, Ed?
Does it strike you as a little odd that the kid's reporting his sex life to us? Does it make you blush a little?
It would if he were telling me face to face. The email method is best for this, I think. Less human content. You're happy with the security of the information transfer?
Yeah, we've been through this. The message could just be sensitive business information, and the encryption system is very robust. The boys and girls at Fort Meade can break it, but it's brute force every time, and it takes up to a week, even after they make the right guesses on how the encryption system works. The PRC guys would have to go from scratch. The trapdoor in the ISP was very cleverly designed, and the way we tap into it should also be secure. And even then, just because an embassy phone taps into an ISP doesn't mean anything. We have a consular official downloading pornography from a local website through that ISP as another cover, in case anybody over there gets real clever. That had been carefully thought through. It would be something that one would wish to be covert, something the counterintelligence agency in Beijing would find both understandable and entertaining in its own right, if and when they cracked into it. Anything good? Ed Foley asked again, just to bedevil his wife. Not unless you're into child abuse. Some of the subjects for this site are too young to vote. If you downloaded it over here, the FBI might come knocking on your door. Capitalism really has broken out over there, eh? Some of the senior party officials seem to like this sort of thing. I guess when you're pushing 80, you need something special to help jumpstart the motor. Mary Pat had seen some of the photographs, and once had been plenty. She was a mother, and all of those photographic subjects had been infants once, strange though that might seem to a subscriber to that website. The abusers of girls must have thought that they all sprang into life with their legs spread and a welcoming look in their doll child faces. Not quite, the DDO thought. But her job wasn't to be a clergyman. Sometimes you had to do business with such perverts, because they had information which her country needed. If you were lucky, and the information was really useful, then you often arranged for them to defect, to live in the United States, where they could live and enjoy their perversions to some greater or lesser degree, after being briefed on the law, and the consequences of breaking it. Afterward, there was always a bathroom and soap to wash your hands. It was a need of which she'd availed herself more than once. One of the problems with espionage was that you didn't always do business with the sort of people whom you'd willingly invite into your home. But it wasn't about Miss Manners. It was about getting information that your country needed to guard its strategic interests, and even to prevail in war if it came to that. Lives were often at stake, either directly or indirectly. And so you did business with anyone who had such information, even if he or she wasn't exactly a member of the clergy. "Okay, babe, keep me posted," Foley told his wife. "Will do, honey bunny." The DDO headed back to her own office. There she drew up her reply to Nomori. "Message received. Keep us posted on your progress. MP. Ends." The reply came as a relief to Nomori when he woke and checked his email.